Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Greg Wilford, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas, who takes a look at Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's decisive victory over his opponents in the August 15th recall referendum. Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses presidential candidate John Kerry's often ambiguous position on the Iraq War, and Oscar Castro with the American Friends Service Committee, who discusses his group's efforts to provide youth with information to counter U.S. military recruiters targeting high school students. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Reuters reports that Sudanese police, sent to stabilize the war-torn Darfur region, are committing new atrocities. In recent weeks, the government in Khartoum sent 10,000 police to Darfur to show the United Nations Security Council that it can provide security in the region. If the situation does not improve quickly, the UN has threatened to impose sanctions on Sudan. During the 18-month conflict in Darfur, over a million Sudanese people have been displaced, and the UN claims that 50,000 people have died in what the international body now calls the world's worst humanitarian disaster. In a deal that Sudan has signed with Jan Pronk, the U.S. Special Representative to Sudan, the government has agreed to set up so-called safe areas for a million people in Darfur, where villagers can search for food and water without any fear of attack by the Janjaweed Arab militias. On August the 23rd, a new round of peace talks between Sudan and rebel factions is set to take place in Nigeria. Meanwhile, 300 troops from the African Union continue to monitor the often broken ceasefire in Darfur that was signed in April. The London-based independent newspaper reports that American soldiers in Afghanistan are wary of taking on the nation's drug lords. Yet, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld implied in August that an aggressive anti-heroin operation may be launched after the October Afghan election. For the moment, U.S. troops bypass opium fields and actively recruit warlords in the fight against terrorism, many of whom are suspected of engaging in drug smuggling. Large-scale opium production has returned to Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban in late 2001. But many fear a large-scale anti-heroin sweep would backfire, with drug lords likely to wage counter-attacks against U.S. forces. Recent roadside bombings and attacks on U.S. troops in southern Afghanistan have been blamed on criminal gangs in addition to Taliban insurgents. U.S. commanders are now ready to take on drug smugglers because they believe that for the first time, Taliban rebels are using drug trafficking to finance their operations. After the October election, the U.S. is expected to use its 1,000 Special Forces troops in Afghanistan to gather intelligence and to go on the offensive against drug lords. To continually deliver low prices to consumers, the retail giant Walmart relies on hidden public subsidy, government-funded health insurance, and other social programs for its low-paid workforce. A new study by the Berkeley Labor Center at the University of California estimates that taxpayers in California pay $86 million a year in public subsidies, such as discounted school lunches and food stamps, to eligible Walmart workers. Walmart, the world's biggest retailer, is moving to enter the lucrative California market, which indirectly led to a bitter strike between several grocery chains and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the study concluded that Walmart and Sam's Club's workers make 31% less than the average retail worker in California, and the typical Walmart worker is 50% more likely to lack health insurance. The University of California study also concluded if other retailers or grocery chains adopted the Walmart model, it would cost state taxpayers $410 million a year in public assistance programs for workers, in effect shifting labor costs from the corporation to the taxpaying public. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Having survived a failed 2002 coup attempt, crippling strikes and sporadic violence, Venezuela's populist President Hugo Chavez triumphed again on August 15th as he decisively beat back an attempt to remove him from office in his nation's first-ever recall referendum. Despite a hard-fought campaign waged against him by opposition groups, made up of Venezuela's wealthy minority and business leaders backed by the Bush administration, the former paratrooper won the referendum by a 58% to 42% margin. Chavez's government received overwhelming support from the nation's poor majority, which has benefited from $1.7 billion in social spending obtained from oil profits. Despite ratification of the election results by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and Organization of American States Secretary General Cesar Gaviria, the opposition rejected the outcome, charging they had lost the referendum due to a gigantic fraud. But the results of the referendum calmed concerns on the international oil market that a defeat of Chavez could usher in a wave of instability in Venezuela, the world's fifth-largest exporter of oil. Chavez, who has now won 2 presidential elections and 6 referendums, will complete his term in office, which ends in 2006. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas, who takes a look at Venezuela's referendum results and what the future may hold for Chavez and his opponents.
Well, first of all, I think it was a pretty stunning victory, actually, for the Chavez government, because I assumed Chavez would win, but I didn't think it would be by that much, although I thought it was possible because the polls coming into the referendum indicated that Chavez would win at least by 10%. And anybody who studies the polling situation here in Venezuela knows that they tend to underestimate the vote in the barrios, because most pollsters don't go into the barrios at all, so then it underestimates the Chavez vote. And so I think actually the 15% margin by which he won is definitely very believable, contrary to what the opposition thinks.
What has been the opposition reaction? From what I've heard, they have called the results a gigantic fraud and thus far are unwilling to accept the results.
They're basically saying that it's a big fraud, and they have, amazingly enough, absolutely no shred of proof or any evidence that there was any fraud. And Cesar Gaviria, the president of the OAS, or general secretary of the OAS, and former President Jimmy Carter of the Carter Center, both said, if you have any evidence, show it to us. We're willing to look at it. So far, we haven't seen any. So the only basis that they have for claiming this massive fraud, supposedly, are their exit polls. But there's absolutely no track record of exit polls here in Venezuela. And so I think they have absolutely no leg to stand on.
Does the opposition, in your view, have any international allies, the Bush administration or anyone else that's going to insist that there be a full recount or in other ways question certification of the results?
Well, it does seem that the Bush administration is an ally. Today I saw a statement by one of the spokesman people from the State Department saying something like that they basically accept the results, but there were they buy the opposition line that there are some questionable incidents. Or I can't remember exactly the words they used, but something to that effect, implying that there was some kind of a shade of a doubt. They're basically supporting the opposition in its call for a recount or for an audit, although it's not clear exactly what kind of audit.
There were reports after the election results were announced that there was some rock throwing and some shootings that resulted in the death of at least one opposition person. Maybe you can talk about what's happened on the streets after the election, as well as prospects for violence in the near term.
The Chavistas went out and celebrated, basically, in the barrios mostly. And people were very elated and excited, those who support the government. The opposition, in the meanwhile, had asked for people to go out and demonstrate against the massive fraud, as they called it. And at one of those demonstrations, actually the only demonstration that I was aware of, there was a confrontation of some sort. And to me, it looks very suspicious. That is, there's absolutely no reason for any Chavista to go around shooting anybody. And so it seems to me much more like a typical thing that the radical opposition does, incite violence and then blame it on Chavez. There have been numerous other occasions like that.
This is actually President Hugo Chavez's 8th victory. He's won 2 presidential elections and 6 referendums now. What's ahead for his Bolivarian revolution?
Well, that's kind of a big question. My feeling is that in some sense he will try to carry his reforms further. There's a lot of problems with some of the social programs he's instituted. That is, they've had to institute them outside of the normal state structures. You know, these missions, these social missions that they've created for providing literacy training or for providing subsidized food or free healthcare and on-the-job training and things like that. Those are all have all been created outside of the normal state structures. And so it's my guess that one of the things the Chavez government will have to do is somehow reconcile these missions with the existing state structures. And what that means, in effect, is a fundamental reform of the state, which is completely inefficient here and corrupt, and Chavez hasn't been able to fix it so far. I think that his supporters will be pushing for a deepening of what they call here participatory democracy. That is, many of the communities want to make sure that this concept of participatory democracy is carried further than it has so far. What that means, for example, is instituting the local planning council that they still plan to introduce, moving forward the urban land reform, for example. I mean, there's a number of different programs that constitute, so to speak, the core of participatory democracy here in Venezuela that have been slow in advancing, and I think those will be carried on.
One last question. From your vantage point inside Venezuela, what is the impact of this referendum victory by Hugo Chavez on the rest of Latin America?
Well, I think Chavez so far has been, so to speak, the maverick in Latin America. That is, he was the first one in recent years to buck the trend and to go against the what's known as the Washington Consensus or the neoliberal economic programs of most Latin American countries. And so I think what his victory shows that it is possible to go against these policies despite what the U.S. wants or despite what the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank want. And so in that sense, I think he's blazing a path and will serve as an inspiration for people who are looking for a different kind of model, even though many people are afraid of this kind of authoritarianism. But it's simply based on a prejudice about Chavez as being a former officer, but there's no basis for that, I think. And so I think he will serve as an example.
That was Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas. Read his articles online at www.venezuelaanalysis.com. As the war in Iraq continues, rebel attacks have spread to almost all corners of the nation. Battles between U.S. troops, Iraqi forces, and militiamen loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have broken out again in the holy city of Najaf, Baghdad's Sadr City, and in other towns across southern Iraq. The U.S. campaign to drive Muqtada al-Sadr out of Najaf comes as other insurgent groups continue to carry out attacks against American troops and members of the Iraqi military and police force. A three-day conference in Baghdad, organized to elect a commission that will plan Iraqi elections next year, was disrupted on August 15th by mortar attacks and protests by delegates who demanded that the U.S. end its siege of Najaf. Amid this violence and chaos, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry surprised many when he answered a reporter's question about whether he would still have voted to give President Bush the authority to go to war, even knowing what we know now about the non-existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Kerry answered by saying, "Yes, I would have voted for the authority. I believe it was the right authority for a president to have." Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, who assesses Senator Kerry's often ambiguous position on Iraq and how this may affect the support of progressive voters in the coming presidential election.
Yeah, wasn't that an amazing, deplorable statement that Kerry made, a real slap in the face to liberal Democrats, progressive Democrats, peace activists who were on the Howard Dean bandwagon or Dennis Kucinich or who were for Nader last time and decided to fold their principles and put him into Kerry's pocket only to see him pull out that promise and rip him up. You know, why in the world would he say at this late date that he still would give the authority to the president to go to war against Iraq? First of all, that authority, that resolution in October 2002 was based primarily on the allegation that Iraq was a continuing threat. Well, if Iraq doesn't have weapons of mass destruction, it's not a continuing threat. Therefore, he shouldn't have given the president that authority. Furthermore, the authority itself was so widespread, so much of a blank check that to even now say it's still the right thing to do to give the president that kind of authority is to really raise questions as to what kind of president Kerry will be. Maybe he wants to be an imperial president, because look at that authority set. It's up to the president, as he determines, to see whether it's time to go to war or not, at his determination. That's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution says Article 1, Section 8, Congress should declare war. This was an abdication of Congress's constitutional obligations and just gave the president a blank check, and Kerry seems to want that blank check.
Kerry and his aides made the distinction that he really didn't mean he'd prosecute the Iraq war again, knowing what he knows now, but merely that he feels the president, any president, should have the authority to go to war. Do you think this statement, in retrospect, was a blunder, or was it a deliberate statement of his feeling about presidential power and the place of Congress?
Oh, I think it was a deliberate statement. I think the advisors, you know, were up all night crafting how, you know, to maneuver right through this little channel here and keep Kerry on both sides of this issue. Another thing Kerry has said on the subject that I picked up during the debates of the Democratic primaries was that at one of the debates, Kerry even said that Bush didn't have to go to the Senate to go to war, that Clinton had gone to war against Haiti and gone to war in Bosnia and in East Timor without a congressional authorization of force, so Bush really didn't need to go to the Senate. Well, if that's his view of what the constitutional arrangements are for going to war, we're going to be in some trouble no matter whether Bush wins or Kerry wins.
At the Boston Democratic National Convention, Kerry and his advisors made it quite clear their priority was to convey to the American people that the Democrats were to be trusted. There's a phobia about looking weak on defense. Certainly in the post-September 11th era, it makes some sense politically. But what do you make of the message being sent out by John Kerry and the Democrats vis-a-vis John Kerry's opening line in the acceptance speech, John Kerry reporting for duty? I mean, the whole thing was so militarily oriented. Do you think that's going to get him any kind of credibility with those middle-of-the-road voters that the Democrats are so desperate to get in November?
It might. I didn't mind the John Kerry reporting for duty line, because I think it spoke to the fact that he could be commander-in-chief. But the stuff about his speech was that bothered me was the suggestion that, you know, he's going to keep the Pentagon spending as high as the Republicans are, and it's soaring now toward $500 billion. And the idea that he can run, you know, only on the claim that he can salute the flag as crisply as the Republicans can, and he can pray Sunday to Sunday as well as Republicans can, and then we'll give you a few more tax breaks here and there on some social issues, vote for me. I don't think that was compelling enough, even for those middle-of-the-road people. I think one of the reasons they didn't have a bounce, the Kerry people, is because they didn't demonstrate to the American people exactly how scary Bush is. And it's my contention that the Bush crowd is more scary than any crowd in the White House since Richard Nixon roamed the halls drunk late at night wondering whether he should bomb Capitol Hill.
There are certainly many progressives out there that are very frightened by the actions of this White House, President Bush. Does that mean that the Kerry campaign can take progressive voters for granted? Or are there a lot of people who are upset by Kerry's position on saying he would have authorized all over again the resolution to give Bush the power to go to war in Iraq? Is that kind of thing going to cause progressive voters to stay home?
Kerry's got to be very careful right here. With this kind of belligerent language towards Iraq, and with this idea that he wants to be the imperial president, which is the way I read that statement he made last week about the authorization of force, he is close to scaring away some of those Nader voters who've decided, okay, this time we'll go with you because Bush is so bad. If he keeps talking like that, some of those people are either going to vote for Nader or more likely vote for the Green Party, David Cobb candidate. He needs to be careful about that, and it's not only for the 2.7% of the people who voted for Nader last time, or two-thirds of those who were progressives. He also needs to appeal to people across the country who are sick of this war, including moderate Republicans or military families. They're upset about that war. But Kerry, nonetheless, has got to be careful that he doesn't alienate the progressive voters who are going almost unanimously. I still get emails from people who are going to be principled and stubborn. And I respect people who are principled and stubborn, and I respect people who are settling for a marriage of convenience this time. But those who are settling for a marriage of convenience on November 3rd are going to file for divorce, and it's going to be messy.
That was Matthew Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine. Read his commentary titled, Carry on Iraq, Yes to the Imperial President, online at www.progressive.org or call the magazine at area code 608-257-4626. As the war in Iraq continues to go badly for American-led forces, there are indications that the U.S. military is having trouble meeting its quotas for new recruits. Earlier this year, the Pentagon issued stop-loss orders to keep thousands of GIs on active duty in Iraq, even though they have fulfilled their service requirements. New recruits who signed up under the delayed entry program used to wait almost a year before being activated, but now the Pentagon is calling them sooner, thus making filling its quota for the following year potentially more difficult. In another indication of disruptions caused by the Iraq War, President Bush announced on August 16th the redeployment of 70,000 U.S. troops from Europe and Korea to U.S. bases in areas closer to terrorist threats. Some 12,000 American troops in South Korea will soon be sent to Iraq. Oscar Castro is with the National Youth and Militarism Program of the American Friends Service Committee, based in Philadelphia. He was a presenter at a counter-recruitment workshop at the Boston Social Forum in July, where he talked about methods military recruiters use to convince young people to sign up, including often illusory promises of training, jobs, and money for college. His organization presents the other side of the picture, for example, informing youth that under the delayed entry program, before they are called up, they can change their minds about joining the military and suffer no adverse consequences. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Castro about his group's counter-recruitment campaign.
My biggest concern is that young people are being recruited into the military under false pretenses and under illusions of patriotism and honor, as well as under the illusion of getting something like money for college or a career opportunity, etc., and that they're not being told that they could die, that they could get sick, that they could get raped, that they could get sexually harassed, that they won't get the money for college. And that's my biggest concern, that they're being misled into the military.
You said 65% of those who sign up don't get the benefits they thought they were entitled to, like $50,000 for college, because they don't fulfill all the requirements necessary. And military recruiters never tell them about those things. But is it spelled out in the contract, and it's just that recruiters verbally are less than honest?
It's in the small print. I mean, it's part of military regulations that enable that. And in order to get even the full $50,000, they say up to $50,000. Some recruiters will say, you're going to get $50,000. I guarantee it. They won't put it in writing. They're not told that in order to do that, they also have to qualify for the Army-Navy College Fund. And very few people will qualify for the Army-Navy College Fund and have the right test scores in order to get the full $50,000 and leave the military under honorable conditions and et cetera, et cetera. It's in the fine print. Military recruiters don't usually read the fine print. You'd be challenged to get even a military enlistment contract for your parents to read. Why would you want your parents to read that? And, just sign.
And what percentage don't get honorable discharges, and what percent don't serve their full hitch? You said both these things prevent enlistees from getting their benefits.
Yeah, it's about 20 to 25%, I believe, of people who don't get, who get discharged under less than honorable conditions. And therefore, even though they've put $1,200 of their hard-earned money, if you will, into the GI Bill package deal, they don't get that back. They don't get anything that they might have accumulated in terms of the matching of the funds. So if you're booted out of the military under a bad conduct discharge other than honorable, even general discharge, you don't get the money for college. You have to get out with an honorable discharge. Otherwise, you don't get anything at all.
What is the racial breakdown of recruits?
Well, in the African-American community, it's disproportionate. African-Americans are about 13% of the nation in general population, particularly if we're talking about recruitment age folk, too. But there are over 20% of the nation's military, with the largest proportion being in the Army, which is the largest branch, really. In the Latino community, which is just a little bit above the African-American community, about 13.5% and rising. They're underrepresented in the military, roughly about 9.5% of the nation's military, which is a concern for the military.
You raised concerns about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's comment before the war started that it would be fought predominantly by white military personnel, reflecting the still majority white population of the U.S. You didn't agree with that?
He didn't go into the whole idea of how they wage war. You know, they send in the elite troops. They send in the Navy SEALs. They send in the Marine Corps. They send in the Green Berets. They send in all the Army Rangers. They send in all of these folk who are overwhelmingly white men, not even women, of course. They go in and they make the early mess. But who comes back to the front line to either maintain what these folks have done or to continue doing, you know, continue moving? And it's overwhelmingly people of color, poor people, African-American, poor white. Latinos are overwhelmingly represented in combat positions, even though they're underrepresented in the entire military. So there are almost 18% of them who are in the military are in combat positions. And there's a lot to say about that culturally and whatnot, economically. You get more pay if you're in those more dangerous roles. You know, war is war. And whether you are a soldier who happens to be a mechanic or an infantryman, if you're anywhere in that theater of war, and particularly if we just look at the lens of Iraq and the whole problem we're having with soldiers, you know, in their Humvees with roadside bombs indiscriminately blowing up, not people who are engaging in combat, but people who are going from one place to another, they happen to be wearing a uniform. If you wear the uniform, you're a target. And overwhelmingly, there are a lot of men and women of color who wear that uniform, who aren't there to kill or be killed, per se, that are in harm's way and will be in harm's way. And a lot of them have been experiencing that in Iraq.
And that was Oscar Castro of the National Youth and Militarism Program of the American Friends Service Committee. For more information, call area code 215-241-7176 or visit their website at www.afsc.org/youthmil. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 as well as real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.